Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. I'm Ryan Dobson, along with our host, psychologist and best-selling author, Dr. James Dobson. And today we're going to finish the conversation we began yesterday with Rabbi Daniel Lappin as we discuss his book, Buried Treasure, on the intricacies of the Hebrew language. Now, before we jump into the program, let me provide you with a little bit of context. Yesterday we discussed the importance of the Torah, or as most evangelicals call it, the Pentateuch, meaning the first five books of the Bible. And as a side note, if you missed part one of this program, you can visit drjamesdobson.org or our Family Talk app and click on today's broadcast to find the broadcast archive. Today we're going to go into more specifics on particular words in the Bible that are packed with meaning, and Dad, I'm going to let you take it from here.
What is the Hebrew word for face? You talk about that in your book.
Yes, I do, and this is also very interesting. The Hebrew word for face, it sounds like this in Hebrew, panim. But the key thing to notice about it is that it is a plural word. That means that there is no singular word for face. That means, according to the Torah, at the very least, I'm two-faced. Because I can't be one-faced. There isn't a word for face. There's only a word for faces. Therefore, I don't have a face. I have faces. Minimum two, maybe more. Isn't that a bad thing to be multi-faced?
Absolutely.
It would seem. But all it's telling us is that there is an appropriate face to wear under appropriate circumstances. There was a couple I once knew that took hundreds of hours of counseling because the husband didn't understand that the face he used for his employees was not the same face that he should use for his children. And he used to speak to his children and address his children the way he addressed his employees. And it wasn't nice. He owned a slaughterhouse. And he used to, you know, he would yell and scream at the people who worked for him, which wasn't nice either. But then he'd come home and treat his children exactly the same way, which caused incredible distress to his wife. And he didn't understand that the face I put on when I go and visit my bank manager is not the same face I use when I'm having a romantic evening with my wife. And that's not the same face I use when I have to teach a course. In other words, there's such a thing as putting on the appropriate filter to our insides. And that's another aspect of the Hebrew word for face, is a window to the inside.
Yeah. Well, if I can try to articulate the theme of your book, it's that the books of the Bible, the Torah especially, were written in a God language that carry in each instance with each word certain information beyond what you're reading. And there is God truth hidden in there that you can apply to your life. And I suppose I could say that's why Christian translations of the Bible vary a lot. They're not the same words from one translation to another. But the Torah and the what we would call the Old Testament scriptures
Right. Don't
change. You don't change from one translation to another because you have an original language.
That's right. There. We're not working with a translation. We're working with an original language which behaves like no other language because in it are embedded astonishing things. And what, you know, just to give you a quick example as we move on, you know, if a newcomer, a new immigrant, you start teaching them English and you tell them a car is a four-wheeled conveyance, and then you might, the next day, you might teach them that a pet is a domesticated animal you keep in your house. And then the third day, they come across the word carpet, and they start trying to figure out, what does this have to do with a four-wheeled conveyance that a domesticated? You say to them, no. A carpet's a covering on a floor. It has nothing to do with a car. It has nothing to do with a pet. In Hebrew, that never happens. Any word in Hebrew made up of other words is revealing that those concepts described by the words are in fact enjoy the same relationship in terms of being made up and unified in that fashion. And so much of this spills over into practical guidance in how to run our families.
Is that true just of the first five books of the Bible? Or is it true of all Old Testament literature?
It's all the way through, all the Old Testament.
And how in the world can people who will never learn to speak or read Hebrew make sense out of this?
Well, I'll tell you something very interesting. Susan and I have been doing programs in a number of churches around the country, most recently in Dallas, where we do a 14-hour program spread over 2.5 days, at the end of which people with no prior background are reading out of the Old Testament in the original Hebrew with a pretty good level of comprehension. And so because it's the Lord's language, you don't have to use Rosetta Stone or Berlitz or anything like that. It's God's soul being opened to ours. And it's amazing how quickly people can learn Hebrew. Quite amazing.
Is it true that Hebrew was a dead language for a period of time?
No, as a matter of fact, that's not true. I know it's very often said, and in fact, even Jewish sources wrongly make that mistake. What they're saying is that for 2,000 years, after the destruction of the temple about 2,000 years ago, till the formation of the State of Israel in 1948, there was no nation, there was no country of which Hebrew was the official language.
But it was still very much alive.
But sure, of course, because in every single generation, people were studying the Old Testament, and they were studying it in Hebrew. So little kids today in New York or Baltimore or Chicago or Miami, little Jewish kids are fluent in Hebrew even though they've never been to Israel because they study Bible.
Mm-hmm. And your book really deals with that concept and explaining how we can get meaning for life from those words, which we read in English, those of us in the West, but there is also information to be gained there by studying the context of the Jewish culture. And that concept came through to me when Shirley and I took a trip to Israel some time ago. It was actually 1993. And the leader, Ray Vanderlaan, took us from one archaeological dig to another, to what's called tells, and talked about them in Hebrew terms. Most of the Christian Bible, the New Testament, is written in Greek, which is a whole different culture. And to really understand it, you need to understand the ancient Jewish culture.
That's exactly right. And so what this book, Buried Treasure, does is essentially give a window into God's mind, really, through the Lord's language. And it allows people with no Hebrew background at all to enjoy the thrill of watching deep, blindingly incandescent, brilliant wisdom literally leap out of the words themselves and shed light on so many of the dilemmas of modern living.
Well, it kind of makes me jealous that I know the English words, but I don't know the Hebrew words. In order to be a minister, which I'm not, Christian minister, many of the theologians have to study both Hebrew and Greek, and I suppose we all should in some way.
Well, you're exactly right, and I've discovered that almost without exception, the colonial pastors in early America were all masters of Hebrew. I mean, Ezra Stiles became the president of Yale University, and he was an outstanding Hebrew scholar. Then there was Cotton Mather, who was absolutely fluent in Hebrew. Mm. And so these are some of the things I learned when I first came to the United States. And I really saw that. I think President Abraham Lincoln called the founders of this country Old Testament Christians.
Mm.
And I saw, you know, how remarkably accurate that was, and that that these were people who knew more about the Old Testament than the average American Jew does today.
Well, that's fascinating. Rabbi, I've got one more to ask you because I know this will be interesting to my dad, and that is the word parents, because we talk a lot about our children shaped by nature, or is it by the nurturing of their parents? And you've got some interesting things about the word parents from the Bible.
Yes. This is a very tough one, Ryan, and I'll tell you why. It's a very, very tough one because, you know, my own sister, as things worked out, became a single mother. She raised and is raising three children without her husband, from whom she's divorced. And so it's always difficult. But let me go ahead and describe what the ideal is, recognizing that heroic women particularly are in fact doing an amazing job raising children and doing the best they absolutely can. But in Hebrew, the Hebrew word for parents does not exist in the singular. And so there isn't such a thing in Hebrew. You cannot say a parent. You cannot say a single parent. You can say a mother and you can say a father, but you can only say parents. From which we see that recognizing that not everybody can be fortunate enough to be in that situation, nonetheless, the ideal is that parenting is done by two people, a man and a woman. And that it's not possible for the process of parenting per se. You can be a great mother, you can be a great father, but to be part of a team of parents, you need the other person. And and that's a stark and sometimes painful truth, but if we don't at least know the truth and the ideal, then we will be hopelessly and utterly lost in society. And recognizing that, that single parents do exist and recognizing that many single moms do an amazing job, we would never want to make the mistake of now recognizing that to be the new ideal or the new reality, which is being done in many feminist circles. Who needs a man, right? You need a man like a fish needs a bicycle, is what they say. So Old Testament would disagree, the Lord's language would disagree, and say no, parenting is very much a man and a woman doing one of the most exciting things that a man and woman can ever do together. And the second thing about it is that the word Hebrew word for parents also embodies the words for moral instruction. And that's very helpful as well, because parenting isn't just making sure that an ovum gets fertilized by a sperm and then calling that, you know, job well done or mission accomplished.
Right.
Our children sometimes say to us, for how long are you going to be watching over us and directing us? You know, and the answer is till our last breath, and then after that we'll haunt you.
That's right.
Because that's the job.
Yeah.
That's the description that came with the job.
So in essence, with regard to Ryan's question, you have both nurture and nature, and they both play a role. But the thing that we get out of the scripture is that you need two parents if possible. It's not always ideal. You have to go with what you have. Sometimes a woman is abandoned by her husband or the other way around.
Absolutely.
So it doesn't always work the way it ought to, but that's the way it ought to.
At least we have to keep a focus on the ideal, at least.
Well, what do you think about, I know your answer to this, but think about same-sex marriage where you have a child being raised by two women or two men.
I think it's tragic for us to accept as normative something which is a complete violation of the biblical plan for a man and a woman. One must anticipate dire consequences down the road, sure.
Rabbi, I mentioned at the top of the program that I wanted to talk to you just a little bit. We're almost out of time, but about Israel and what's taking place there. I am a great lover of Israel. I knew I loved it before I went there, but afterwards it burned within me. And the scriptures make it very clear that God loves Jerusalem. He said, pray for the peace of Jerusalem.
That's right.
And all the other historical things that took place there. What do you think is happening now that we have a president that does not seem to me to revere that ancient place and this ancient people?
Well, first of all, I just want to say that one of the most meaningful moments that I've enjoyed in your company, and I'm wondering if you'll remember this, is you and I were at a lunch. I called you and asked you to come to this lunch. It was a very private lunch in Washington, D.C., and this took place, I believe it was in February 2004, if I remember correctly. Mm. We made that luncheon because the Israel had sent over a representative wanting to talk to Christian leaders about returning Gaza.
Gaza. I remember that very well.
And there were about, you were there with maybe 12 of your colleagues, perhaps, and I was there, and the gentleman that the Prime Minister of Israel had sent was there as well. He subsequently became a Prime Minister of Israel himself, you'll remember.
Yes.
But around that table, you got up and you told the story of sitting with your parents
in front
of the radio.
Yeah, it was my mother.
As the state of Israel came into existence, and you were watching and listening to it over the radio.
And that was May 15th, 1948.
That's correct. And you told the story. And I think your mother said something to you at the time as well, too.
She said, with great emotion, that we've been waiting for this day all of our lives, and our ancestors, too, have waited for this moment when Israel would become a nation again.
Well, that made an enormous impression on the Israeli representative, and I remember very, very well. It's nine years ago. It's not that long ago, but I do remember that. And yes, we now do have a president who I think has as a general policy placating our enemies and antagonizing our friends. I mean, that's his attitude. And so anything for Iran, he basically single-handedly has brought chaos and turbulence into the Arab world with his so-called Arab Spring genius. So, yes, I mean, Israel is without question a victim to the new world order that he envisages, and it's a world order in which America has a far reduced presence and a far reduced influence. And it's a world order in which Israel ideally doesn't exist, frankly.
See, I not only don't understand that, but it defies logic. Israel is our only real ally in the Middle East. And that's the reason that America has supported it and defended it. And then you consider the Holocaust and the slaughter of 6 million Jews in World War II. And that suffering has occurred down through history. It's not just in that war, but my goodness, I think it was King Edward I that threw the Jews out of Britain. Pulling this out of the air, but that's what I remember.
It was
not till Cromwell brought them back in the 1600s. I may have that all wrong.
No, you don't.
You have it right.
You have it right.
But there has been such suffering, and here the Jewish people are surrounded by people that want to drive the nation into the sea or completely incinerate it.
Here's the problem with that approach, and everything you've said is true. But not everything true is necessarily politic. And the problem with that approach is that the Islamic world says, look, you Europeans are the ones who oppressed the Jews. Like you said, you threw them out of England, you threw them out of Germany, you killed them in the Holocaust. So you give them a land. Why don't you give them a piece of Italy? Why don't you let them have a nice piece of Sweden? Or how about you give them Scotland? But why on earth should you placate your wicked conscience by giving them a piece of our land right here in the Middle East?
Well, one of the reasons is because it's covenant land.
Ah, that's the real reason, exactly. And so, really, I mean, the world is divided today into two kinds of people. People who believe that the Bible is the word of God and people who don't. And the people who believe the Bible is the word of God are in favor of doing everything they can to help Israel survive. And those who don't wish it would vanish.
Hmm. Well, you
mentioned I can comfortably say where our current leader finds himself.
Yeah. You mentioned remembering a conversation with me. Let me recall one for you. We were at a rally out on the mall there in Washington, D.C., and you and I were standing there, and there were about 100,000 or more people out there who were celebrating the meaning of marriage. And you and I talked about several things, including Israel. And I said, Rabbi, why is it that most of your Jewish brothers and sisters defend abortion and things that are counterproductive for Israel, and many of them do not support the land of Israel and America's defense of it? Why is that? And what I remember you saying to me is because they care more about their ideology than they do the land of Israel.
Yeah, that's right. And by that day, you will remember, was pouring with rain. Do you remember?
It sure was.
While you and I, we both spoke to the crowd that day with the water pouring down our necks.
Yes. I've had many conversations with you, and I remember most of them, and I will remember this one today as well.
Well, thank you very much. I remember that too. But that's it. That's exactly true. And I wrote a book explaining it. I wrote a book called America's Real War. An Orthodox rabbi insists that Judeo-Christian values are vital for our nation's survival. And in it, I explain why it is that more than half of Jewish Americans care more about the doctrines of the Democratic Party than they do about the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
Do you feel that America is losing ground morally?
There's no question about it. The only question is whether it's a recoverable situation or whether we're doomed. And I believe it's recoverable, but it's only recoverable through the third great religious reawakening. I think it's going to be recoverable only by a burst of passionate, fervent Christianity. Mm. Nothing else will do it.
Well, that's what we're praying for, too. And you know about my wife's National Day of Prayer. That movement is just growing by leaps and bounds because many, many deeply committed Christian people are worried about that too, and they are praying. And we're
absolutely
seeing the evidence of that growth in the prayer movement, and that's our only hope.
It's been my honor to be a speaker for that event for a number of years.
And you sure have.
And I come specifically because I do believe that that is the only hope for this country and for all the many millions around the world who depend on this country.
Well, I'm so glad to have had this conversation today. Ryan has been taking it in over there, but he's paying attention,
it's
too.
It's a good one.
Yeah. And well, let's do it again, shall we?
I look forward to that. Absolutely. Ryan, thanks very much indeed.
It was my pleasure, Rabbi. Thank you.
I hope so.
Okay.
All right. God bless you. Take care of yourself.
Same to you.
Thanks.
You've been listening to the conclusion of our interview with Rabbi Daniel Lappin here on Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. If you'd like more information about his book, Buried Treasure, or the Ministry of Family Talk, you can call us at 877-732-6825 or visit our website, drjamesdobson.org. And before we go today, I want to let you know about something very exciting. This month, we're offering two invaluable resources from my dad, Dr. James Dobson, to help dads be the very best fathers and role models they can be for their kids. I'm talking about his books, Dads and Sons and Dads and Daughters. In these books, my dad helps other dads explore the unique blessings and gifts that come from the father-son and father-daughter relationship, and I know that intensely. I can't tell you how important that relationship between me and Lincoln and me and Lucy is, and each book contains an insightful collection of wisdom on how dads can encourage their kids throughout their journey of life and preserve a deep, lifelong connection with them. So give Family Talk a call today and request your copy of one or both of these books, 877-732-6825. You can also find them online at drjamesdobson.org. Thanks again for joining us today, and we'll see you again next time for another edition of Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk.
Family Talk is not affiliated with Focus on the Family.
Hi, this is Ryan Dobson for Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk, and I want to take a moment to let you know about a really exciting opportunity for you to be a part of what God is doing through Family Talk. we have recently received a $400,000 matching grant that doubles every gift you give to equip and empower parents and families. Every dollar you donate this month to Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk immediately becomes $2 towards preserving and promoting the institution of the family. And it's an excellent opportunity to join us in our work, and we can't do it without the faithful support of our listeners. So if you'd like to help us reach the goal of $400,000 and maximize the potential of this grant, please call us right now at 877-732-6825. You can also donate on our website, drjamesdobson.org, on our Facebook page, or through our Family Talk smartphone app.
Hello, everyone. I'm James Dobson. For those of you who enjoy our radio program, Family Talk, I have some good news. When you're not able to hear Family Talk right here on your favorite Christian radio station, you can catch us 24 hours a day by downloading the new and free Family Talk mobile app. Visit your app marketplace to download it today. And thanks for listening to Family Talk.